These are the sounds and voices of 1966, a year of politics.
You did it! And what you've done makes this a great day for us and for the people of Michigan.
A year of controversy.
Ain't no question about it. We just got to organize and stop being ashamed and afraid to tell the man what's been on our mind for 400 years. Because black power is scaring the hell out of them and we ain't even organized yet.
A year of disagreement.
I think it's perfectly safe to say that this is the first work stoppage of college teachers to enforce contract demands of a certified bargaining agent in the history of the United States.
Of violence.
It was a crime of the century. It's one of the worst crimes I've ever seen since I've been coroner in this county in that 6 years.
End of war.
We're getting a lot of casualties. I need help. I got two elements cut off.
These are the events of our time and of our place. Those happenings that each of us, for our own reasons, remember. This is an electronic diary of 1 year, 1966. WKNR News presents the sounds and voices of 1966 as they were gathered and reported by the WKNR News staff. This is Philip Nye. Nearly a decade ago, an unknown author in a little-known book wrote, "Either America is the hope of the world or it is nothing." Perhaps at no time in history have those words held such meaning. Vietnam. The pivotal point of international and national argumentation. As 1 year ended and another began, there was a holiday truce in that undeclared war. The truce gave hope. Hope that perhaps the conflict would move from the jungle battlefields to the conference table. That spark of hope was soon extinguished.
So on this Monday morning in Vietnam, at my direction, after complete and thorough consultation and agreement with the government of South Vietnam, United States aircraft have resumed action in North Vietnam.
January had not ended when the decision was made to again send U.S. bombers north near Hanoi. At home, the battle was between the hawks and doves, and there were no party lines. Among those demanding withdrawal, Democratic Senators Fulbright and Morse. Others said we should fight to win.
To retreat and get out would be deemed a confession that we are a paper tiger.
Minority Leader Senator Everett Dirksen, the most vocal critic of the administration's Vietnam policy, Oregon's Wayne Morse. WKNR News recorded this exchange between the senator and General Maxwell Taylor during a Foreign Affairs Committee hearing.
I happen to hold to the point of view that it isn't going to be too long before the American people, as a people, will repudiate our war in Southeast Asia.
That, of course, is good news to Hanoi, Senator.
I know that that's the smear artist that you militarists give to those of us that have honest differences of opinion with you, but I don't intend to get down in the gutter with you and engage in that kind of debate, General. I'm simply saying that, in my judgment, the President of the United States is already losing the people of this country by the millions in connection with his war in Southeast Asia. And all I'm asking is, if the people decide that this war should be stopped in Southeast Asia, are you going to take the position that's weakness on the home front in a democracy?
I would feel that our people were badly misguided and did not understand the consequences of such a disaster.
Well, we agree on one thing, that they can be badly misguided, and you and the President, in my judgment, have been misguiding them for a long time in this war.
The great debate continued. Senator Fulbright coined a phrase, credibility gap, accusing the Johnson administration of failing to fully inform the public. Michigan's Gerald Ford led the GOP in picking up the call.
There are those in this administration who appear to believe that half a truth is better than none. We disagree. Where the American people at home are concerned, we must have the whole truth.
Later, at a House Un-American Activities Committee hearing, 50 persons were arrested as they vocally protested both the war and the draft. Marches and sit-ins were common. At Detroit's campus marches at mid-year, our WKNR microphones there as those protesting and those heckling the protesters made their opinions known.
End the war in Vietnam! Bring the troops home! End the war in Vietnam! Bring the troops home!
End the war in Vietnam! Bring the troops home!
Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids can you kill today? Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids can you kill today?
Bombing started again yesterday in Vietnam, and the bombing reminded us that we move closer and closer and further into Vietnam and closer to perhaps world war, or at least war in Southeast Asia, which these people are very much concerned with, as all people should be.
Well, I think all these people are traitors to our country.
Well, Vietnam will be ended only when every American soldier is withdrawn from Vietnamese soil.
Again in 66, it was common at colleges to blast the draft. It happened at Ann Arbor, at East Lansing, and most other campuses where the young faced military service. Late in December, a Detroit Episcopal minister, Reverend David Gracie, conducted a school on the draft, or how to beat it. WKNR newsman Ed Mullen questioned Reverend Gracie.
Why hold a conference like this at all? The reason that we felt that we had to do something of this nature was that we had found ourselves as individual churchmen and as members of religious bodies having been tremendously critical of the conduct and the aims of the war in Vietnam. We've branded it an immoral war.
While some at home attended makeshift classrooms on the art of conscientious objecting, the Vietnam War created heroes every day. Among them, Captain Bill Carpenter, former West Point football star who called for napalm strikes on his own company's position to fight back on rushing communists. Captain Carpenter said it was all in a day's work.
They started getting in amongst us, and hell, I just called the airstrike in. That was the only place I could put it where I thought it was effective.
Late in June, a 17-year-old Army private, Robert Maley, armed with a small box of dynamite, barricaded himself in his family's suburban Melvindale home. The youngster set off the dynamite, demolished the house, but miraculously escaped. As Police Lieutenant Frank Green related to WKNR News,
I no more than got out of the door. I still had my hand on the door, and I asked the officers that was standing on the stairs to leave the building and also to get the officers from in front of the place. And I had no more than got it out of my mouth when the blast went off.
Later, Maley, who was AWOL, said he did it all because he didn't want to go to Vietnam. In October, President Johnson embarked on a 17-day six-nation tour of Asia. The trip, if nothing else, emphasized U.S. commitments to that area. The highlight of the president's trip, a visit to American troops at Cameron Bay. Our WKNR microphones were there.
I came here today for one good reason, simply because I just could not come to this part of the world and not come to see you.
Here at home, after some legal maneuvering, Dearborn's Mayor Orville Hubbard managed to get a Vietnam issue on the November ballot, the first such referendum in the nation. The voters rejected it, indicating favor for U.S. policy. But the mayor remained adamant.
It's absolutely wrong being over there. Can't win it. You can't win it militarily or otherwise. It's not going to settle it. As De Gaulle said the other day, here it seems a shame that the people as powerful we are, as we are, going way over there with all of our power to bomb that country with our bombs and butcher those people off. It doesn't make sense anyway when I add it up, in my opinion.
Again in December, another holiday truce and charges and countercharges of violations. As 66 closed, 375,000 Americans were serving in Vietnam. There was no end in sight. ...1966 was an election year, and perhaps Michigan played the major role in a Republican resurgence.
The people have given us a mandate by their votes to continue our work for a better, more vital Michigan that will achieve total progress for all the people of this state.
George Romney, Mormon, former Ottawa executive, and a landslide winner to his third term as governor. The Republican road back in the state had begun when veteran Democratic Senator Patrick McNamara died in the spring. The governor appointed a Traverse City congressman, Robert Griffin, to fill the unexpired term. Griffin, a Detroiter by birth, and son of a factory worker, had co-authored the Landrum-Griffin Bill. This alone gave Democrats elation, for the act was unpopular among labor, mainly because it was misunderstood. Senator Griffin explained it to the rank and file in the hallways of an AFL-CIO convention.
I want every opportunity to explain the Landrum-Griffin bill to the people of Michigan and to rank and file union members, because this is a bill in their interest.
A bill for it or against them?
It's a bill for them.
We got a different idea, Mr.
Well, I know that some of you have, and I'd like to have the opportunity to present the other side. And I think most union members would like to hear both sides.
A young and vigorous Detroit mayor, Jerome Patrick Kavanaugh, announced he would seek the Democratic Party's nomination for the Senate. He took on an old war horse, former six-term Governor G. Menon Williams. In the primary, Kavanaugh was clobbered.
I think we were all well aware of the fact that we were long-shot underdogs, but we wanted to give the people of our state a choice in this primary, and I think we gave them that choice.
The young mayor had picked the wrong time and the wrong place to fight the machine. With the primary victory, the Williams, Michigan magic was apparently again working well.
You ain't seen nothing yet.
As November neared, Governor Romney led what was dubbed the Action Team, campaigning mainly for young Senator Griffin. The governor did have an opponent, longtime Democratic worker Zoltan Ferency. In a Detroit Labor Day appearance, President Johnson's mispronunciation of Ferency's name, he called him Zoltan Ferency, did at least give the underdog some publicity. Later, New York Senator Robert Kennedy came to campaign. He was well aware of the president's faux pas.
And I'm very, very pleased to have an opportunity to support an old associate whose name is well known to us all, Zoltan. Ferency.
Zoltan Ferency probably never expected to win, but he never stopped working. And on November 8th, defeat was accepted graciously.
And I want to say that I pledge my personal cooperation and support to George Romney, and I congratulate him on his victory, and I intend to support every measure calculated to further the interests of the people of the state of Michigan, and give my support whenever I can in good conscience, and I know you will do the same.
As for Soapy Williams, the smile, the green polka dot bow tie, and the constant handshaking so successful in the past were not in with the times.
I'm proud of all of you, each and every one. And may the good Lord bless you and continue to give you strength in the faith that has sustained you up to now. Thanks a million.
Ladies and gentlemen, what you have just heard is more than the concession speech of the Democratic senatorial candidate. It is the passing of a political era in the state of Michigan. G. Menon Williams, known fondly as Soapy, in 20 years of active politicking, has never lost an election until tonight. Tonight he takes...
WKNR newsman George Hunter summed it up well as he reported live from Democratic headquarters. An era had ended. The Statler Hotel, where Republicans held forth, was in direct contrast to Democratic headquarters. There was gaiety and hoopla and victory. The eyes and ears of not only Michigan, but much of the nation focused on George Romney.
You did it! And what you've done makes this a great day for us and for the people of Michigan.
The Romney coattails proved both long and strong. He had, as he had hoped, carried many Republicans to victory, including Robert Griffin. But the big winner, George Romney, began searching for new ways to say he had made no decision as to 1968.
Well, I'm certainly highly complimented that so many people are talking about me in that connection. But I have made no decision in that connection.
I have not made a decision to become a candidate. And I expect to take a long, hard look before I decide whether or not I will be a candidate.
I don't see how any red-blooded American could be other than honored and pleased to have people feel the way these developments indicate.
I've frankly stated that I'm exploring the matter, and certainly any person ought to take a good, hard look at a question as important as this before making the decision.
I have not decided whether I will be a candidate, but only that I will look, take a long, hard look in arriving at a decision.
Elsewhere, the Republicans rebounded from the 64 disaster with a vengeance, picking up 47 seats in the House, gaining 3 in the Senate, and evening up the governorships at 25 each. Other political stars who began their orbits, an ex-actor turned politician, Ronald Reagan, who unseated Governor Pat Brown in California.
We can remember this November 8th as the day that we restored the two-party system.
In Illinois, Charles Percy ousted veteran Democratic Senator Paul Douglas in a campaign marked by personal tragedy. Percy's 21-year-old daughter, Valerie, had been murdered in the family's home. The campaign halted during a period of mourning, leading the victor to thank the man he defeated.
The generosity, the graciousness, and the great understanding that he showed last September is something that I shall never forget.
In Massachusetts, voters elected Edward Brooke as senator, the first Negro to take a Senate seat since Reconstruction days.
The people of this great state have answered all of the George Rockwells, have answered all of the people who would divide us and who would keep men from being brothers.
But the state of Georgia still had no governor as the year ended. The so-called wizened observers were still rehashing the whys of the GOP gains and Democratic losses. Blames were placed on many factors, not the least of which was the growing unpopularity of LBJ. And as for 68, the political pundits had begun taking pot shots at George Romney, surely proving he was the GOP's front runner. The Michigan legislature also felt the gains of the GOP. The House was equally divided. The Republicans controlled the Senate. But as in the past, the state seemed to have more than an average number of bad apples in the Lansing barrel. Among the worst, Detroit Senator Bernard O'Brien, convicted on a morals charge, accused by an MSU co-ed. He said he'll appeal, but his legislative career apparently ended. He did not win renomination. Senator Basil Brown of Highland Park, arrested twice on drunk driving charges, admitted he was an alcoholic, sold his car, turned in his driver's license, and then told WKNR News,
I think the public should expect us to maintain ourselves in a fashion that shows the public trust is in good hands, but still recognize that we're all human, we all have some frailties.
Tax troubles also plagued politicians. Senator Brown, along with Representative James Bradley, charged with failure to pay back taxes. And a shock in Detroit when councilman and former mayor Louis Mariani faced a federal indictment for evading taxes. Mariani has not gone to trial. He remains a councilman. Later, a respected jurist, Recorder's Judge Arthur Kosinski, came under tax charges. The judge had neither filed returns nor paid taxes for 14 years. He settled and quietly resigned his position. As 1966 began, the fourth floor of the old county building was a busy place. A makeshift sign on a closed door stated, "Private, grand jury in session, keep out." One-man grand juror, Judge Edward Piggins, was in the fifth month of his probe when the year started. The grand jury had been appointed to investigate charges of ticket fixing in the sheriff's department. Early in January, Judge Piggins expanded, staging an overnight raid on the Grecian Gardens restaurant, a popular Detroit night spot, arresting owner Costa Kalakasidis and manager Peter Vitale, and confiscating what became known as the Little Black Book, reportedly containing the names of officials on the take. WKNR News questioned Judge Piggins on the widening of his investigation.
We originally started out with the alleged traffic ticket fixing scandal in the sheriff's office. And I believe perhaps the general public got the impression that that was the limitation of our jurisdiction, but it was not, and is not.
The grand juror also subpoenaed police records, raising speculation of a widespread purge in the department. But Judge Piggins denied inferences he was aiming at Police Commissioner Girardin.
Commissioner Girardin
promised me complete cooperation as he has done in the past. And I want to add again that I think Commissioner Girardin is a very fine public servant, a man of integrity, and a good police commissioner.
However, the rumor mill remained in high gear. There were reports of constant surveillance of police headquarters, continuing hints of some major indictments of important public figures. There were charges against police officers accused of taking bribes and bar owners for allegedly giving them. The department's ranks, already understaffed, were thinned further by resignations. Never, however, was that little black book actually linked with any of the officers who stepped down. Police Commissioner Girardin was kept busy defending his department.
Look, this is a tight McCarthyism. Do you remember how wild people were during his era about communism? All right, they're applying it now on a smaller scale, but just as deadly a scale.
In March, the Piggins probe returned to that ticket fix scandal.
Today, the grand jury issued indictments against the sheriff of Wayne County and the undersheriff for a violation of the law, which is generally known as willful neglect of duty.
Said Wayne County Sheriff Peter Buback.
Well, I am very shocked and amazed that Judge Piggins took the action it did. After all, I have 29 years of government service, and my integrity and character has never been questioned. And I'm quite sure that I'll be vindicated in due course in the courts.
As the one-year term of the Piggins investigation came to a close, a petition was filed for a new jury. When circuit judges met and voted, it was not Judge Edward S. Piggins, but Judge George Bowles who assumed the new jury duties.
Now that the bench has spoken through a majority of its members and granted the petition and selected me as their choice for grand juror, I intend to pursue the inquiry vigorously and with the assistance of the most capable staff of aides that can be assembled.
And said Judge Piggins,
it's a little frustrating, you know, to get into the middle of an investigation like this and then suddenly be required to stop. Those who are in the wrong know they're in the wrong, and those who are in the wrong know that I know they're in the wrong. And yet my hands are tied at this moment. It's about like taking the axe out of the woodsman's hand when he's got the tree half chopped down.
By year's end, Judge Bowles' only action, charges against Garden City officials, including now-defeated Mayor Edwin Free, for misuse of public funds. Of those named in Wayne County grand jury action, there have been no trials, rather some dismissals and many lengthy examinations.